just a nice guy. No more, Mr. King. No more, Mr. Nice Guy. They say he's sick, he's obscene.
Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal on WGN 720. And that is the title track, No More Mr. Nice Guy, from Pat Boone, our guest. And it's the 20-year anniversary reissue of the metal album you did, Pat, No More Mr. Nice Guy.
That is so startling to me when you say it. 20 years since that was, it was suddenly front page, lead item on news, on television, and the newspapers. Dick Clark said he never did anything on the American Music Awards, whether it was Michael Jackson, Eminem, Marilyn Manson, whoever it was, that got more instant worldwide coverage than Pat Boone in heavy metal leather and tattoos announcing with Alice Cooper his new heavy metal album. And it just shocked. Of course, it got me kicked off TV, Christian TV, immediately. But I got reinstated about 2 months later, but people thought I had gone over to the dark side. And to some extent, I did put my toe in that water, but it was a big band, heavy metal of saxophones, trombones, and trumpets.
Well, yeah, why'd you decide to do it? I interviewed you 20 years ago for the Sun Times, and mm-hmm. you told me then even your daughter Debbie wasn't too sure about what happened to Dad there.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
What? Why'd you decide to do it? Why'd you decide to bring it back 20 years later?
It was, I'm descended from Daniel Boone,
uh-huh.
and he was a pioneer who liked to go places other people hadn't gone. And I guess I've inherited some of that DNA, and my musicians, and we were on tour in England doing all my hits for the audiences, and it was going very well. But between planes, they said, look, why don't we go in a studio, just us guys, and do something new? And I said, what can I do? I haven't done 10 times already. I'm already more diverse than any other singer ever, having had chart records in country, gospel, pop, rock and roll, movie themes, patriotic, I mean, on and on. So what could I do? He said, well, you never did any heavy metal. And we laughed. It was a joke. But then some of the guys started saying, you know, there's some really good songs in heavy metal that only metal heads know about, and they're big hits, but we could do them a different way. I said, well, how? And my conductor at the time, and still is, Dave Siebel, said, well, big band jazz. I said, whoa, now you're talking. What now? So then they gave me CDs of music that they thought I could do, and we went through maybe 150 songs.
Right, yeah, I remember that, yeah.
And we picked out 12, I think it was, and starting with Enter Sandman, which Dave Siebel himself arranged, Metallica, and from then on, Smoke on the Water, all those songs, and No More Mr. Nice Guy. And MCA heard that I was doing a heavy metal album, and they called me and said, hey, it ought to be here. You know, we have all the rest of your catalog, because I wasn't under contract then. I was just going to do it as a custom project. But I was doing it to try to do something unlike anything I'd ever done. Well, that sure was it. And then Tom Jones, Paul Anka, and others tried to imitate that later, doing alternative songs, but the songs weren't nearly as good. We picked some really good songs, great arrangements, and had a rocking good album that went halfway up the Billboard chart the first week after the American Music Awards. So it was a home run, but who knew? Who expected it? I didn't even.
Yeah, you listen to like about 150 CDs and stuff. You know, I have I've seen Motorhead. I'm kind of a middle of the road metal fan. I have a lot of metal fan friends. A lot of my friends who like classical music like metal music. I mean, were you seriously into this? I mean, did you go to concerts?
No. It was totally foreign to me, and it was just the intrigue of what my musicians were telling me, that underneath all the cacophony, the noise, the screaming, the distortion, there were some good songs. I said, well, prove it to me. What are they? And, of course, all the songs we did were not necessarily heavy metal. They were precursors. But, you know, we did Jimi Hendrix, Wind Cried Mary, Love Hurts by Nazareth. But people didn't, even Nazareth, I don't think, knew that song, Love Hurts, had been introduced by the Everly Brothers
right.
Years before. But most of the songs were rocking good songs. But when I did Paradise City, Slash was going to play guitar on our version, but he was all wrapped up trying to get their group back together again, Guns N' Roses, and so he had to bow out. But when he heard the record later, he said, "Hey, you guys did it faster than we did. I don't know if I could have played the guitar that fast." Well, of course he could have. But we got a great guitarist, and we just had fun doing it. And while we were recording it at Ocean Way, as if it were a live album, all the musicians, triple-scale, top big band musicians. But, of course, we had Greg Bissonette playing drums, and he played both heavy metal and rock and roll and hard rock and big band. But also Sheila E. doing some other right. percussion. Dweezil Zappa playing a Hendrix guitar. I mean, we were getting some of the real ingredients as well as the songs themselves. And people like Fleetwood Mac and others were coming into Ocean Way control room to see what this was all about. And we're walking out saying, "You know, that sounds pretty good." And then you mentioned Motorhead, Poison, Scorpion, and even Aerosmith and others were saying, "Aren't you going to do one of our songs?" And I would have. We were starting to put together another list because, you know, it went way up in the charts. It went to number 3, I think, alternative, which is College. And, you know, that group, age group. And then number 6, I think, Hard Rock. I mean, it was a big album, but MCA thought it was a fluke. And they didn't even service it well in the stores. It sold out immediately. But they were so afraid it was just a fluke, it would die out, that they didn't service it, and they weren't interested in a follow-up album. So I was very disappointed. It was a major hit. And, you know, everywhere I go, every time I perform, and I still do Smoke on the Water in my live shows, but I sneak up on my obviously older audience asking how many went out and rushed out and bought my album of heavy metal classics. And almost, you know, 3 or 4 hands. And, of course, the sound technicians all have it. Wherever I go, they always bring it out for me to sign because people into sound and music had to hear it, as did the college kids. And so they love it. But I asked the audience, "Well, then, if that means you haven't heard any of the music, you want me to sing one of the songs for you?" And there's sort of a half-hearted, "What, yeah, maybe." And then I do Smoke on the Water and with the full big band arrangement, and it gets a tremendous hand, and people go out and buy the album after the show.
Okay, we're going to let's play a little bit of a little snippet of Smoke on the Water, and then we can talk about that after we hear that. Okay.
Okay.
Geneva shoreline.
Smoke on the Water from Pat Boone in a Metal Mood. No More Mr. Nice Guy. You know,
that title is so funny. In a Metal Mood sounds so ridiculous, but that's what we were. That's the way we were kidding about it. You know, that's when are we going to do that Metal Mood album? And you know, we were just joking. But then, as I learned, there were some really good songs, and the idea grew. We kept that title, but with the subtitle, No More Mr. Nice Guy. And I used that to shock Alice Cooper on the American Music Awards because he and I, at Dick Clark's request, gave the award for Hard Rock Heavy Metal. It turned out to be for Metallica. And just the night before, they had heard my version of their song, Enter Sandman. And they told me that it was actually a true story of one of their roadies trying to get his kid to stay in bed and scare him with something's overhead and under the bed and going to get you if you don't stay where you are. That's what that is. Yeah. And if you remember, they're in that album, I mean, in the song, theirs and mine, there's this heavy voice, "And now I lay me down to sleep," and a little child's voice, "And now I lay me down to sleep, pray the Lord my soul," you know, that old prayer. And I asked, "Who was that? Was that one of Metallica's kids?" He said, "No, it's one of our roadies' kids that did that." Well, with me, it was my 4-year-old grandson.
Oh, really?
who did that voice. And so it was fun. The whole thing was fun, just good, clean fun. And there was humor attached to me doing heavy metal. But some critics misunderstood that. They thought I was trying to be a heavy metal artist and not quite getting there. I wasn't growly or crazy or screaming enough. And that was not my point, of course. They missed the point.
Hey, I read once that, and you can tell me this is true, was Ozzy Osbourne one of your neighbors in Beverly Hills?
Yeah, right. In fact,
did you talk to him about this? I mean,
of course. Yeah. Oh, listen,
that's great. Ozzy Osbourne and Pat Boone, neighbors.
You know, we were next door. Just a hedge separated their house and ours. And they moved in just after I had done that album. And I had not met Ozzy. I hadn't been to any of those hard rock concerts but his. I went over, made a point of going over to Las Vegas, the Thomas Mack Arena, to see and hear him in person. And I was warned ahead of time to take earplugs.
Yeah, right.
And I would certainly need them, and I did. And then when I got there, I was offered the extreme honor of being up in the spit pit. I said, well, excuse me, why is it called spit pit? Because you'll probably get spit on. I said, I think I can pass on that. And so I went on the back of the arena with the earplugs, and I saw this incredible show, just Ozzy and about three musicians, two guitarists who jumped up and down and played crazy music like two monkeys on a string. And it was just, I went backstage to see him, but his wife Sharon said, we're sorry, but he wants to see you, but he has to, it takes about a half hour to come down after one of his shows. I had to go catch my plane. So I said, well, tell him I think he needs to be in the Olympics. I don't know which event, but I was so impressed. Well, now right after that, he moved in next door. And I went out to the mailbox to get some mail one morning, and I see him shuffling along the sidewalk, headed to a big black limo. And he said, oh, hello, Pat. Good to meet you. We'll get together, have some tea, okay? And we did, but I'm on my way to an AAA meeting, and he was.
Yeah.
So we got to know each other. I went over several times. We were in the Rolling Stone article with pictures. I was helping him trim his roses and clean stuff out of his pool, which of course he never did. This was just for the pictures.
Yeah.
But you know, when his show hit the air, the Osbourne Family show.
Mm-hmm.
Which took over TV for a few months, several months, you tune in and you hear my version of his Crazy Train as his theme song.
Yeah, yeah.
He and Sharon liked it so much, I couldn't believe it. Crazy, hey, that's how it goes. And he didn't use his version. He used my version. I guess I didn't ask him why, except I knew they liked it. But I think they wanted to make it more palatable to an audience that maybe didn't know much about his music but would tune in to see this reality show, which it really was. But we got to be good friends, and I like Ozzy, and I love Sharon. And the kids, they're turning out much better than I feared they would because of the upbringing they had. But Ozzy and Sharon, really almost like a metal Ozzy and Harriet, come to think of it.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah,
but we got to be friends, and they said on their show in one scene, Sharon said to Ozzy, "Oh, don't you miss Pat Boone? He was the best bleep bleep neighbor we ever had." And I tell people that's because we never called the police. Most of his other their neighbors did call the police on them at some time or another. But we, as I say, got along great. But about 3 years later, they moved away. And at one point, right at that juncture, Meatloaf was looking at the house on the other side of Ozzy, and it was going to be Pat Boone, Ozzy Osbourne, and Meatloaf, three contiguous houses. I mean, we were going to have some kind of neighborhood block party.
Hey, so why did you decide to reissue it? And how can people find it? Where is it at now? And talk about the reissue.
Well, there's still continual call for it.
Uh-huh.
And as I say, MCA just dropped it after a while. I went back to see Bruce Reznikoff, who was the executive who had called me and said, we want the album. I said, why don't you want album too. He said, "Well, we just think it was a fluke. It was good, but we're not sure there's a demand." And I kept saying, "There was a demand after you sold out in the stores." I had so many people tell me they went to the stores, and it was gone. And the store owner would say, "We've ordered, but it just hasn't come in." And you know, people go into a store to buy a record. They make that. They go to that much trouble. They're not going to come back three or four times usually. So if you don't have it when they come in, they'll either forget about it or go somewhere else. But there's been a continuing interest in that album, and I think just letting people know we have and MCA has pressed up more copies. I don't know if they're going to service the stores if people start walking in asking for it because of the PR we're doing. Then fine. Otherwise, they get it online and they can just come to patboone.com, and I'll supply you myself.
Okay, we're going to play another track. What do you want to play, Pat? And then we can talk about, I've got maybe, it's. Why don't you pick it? It's A Long Way to the Top, if you want to rock
and roll.
I like
A Long Way, I'd like to tell you a little story about that.
Okay, why don't you introduce it, and then we'll play a little bit of it. Yeah, take it away.
You know, I need to let you know that when we started calling the top big band jazz arrangers, there was a great trepidation, not the great uncertainty about whether they were happy to do something with Pat Boone, but not heavy metal. I mean, that didn't sound like something that they wanted to do. But we asked him to come to Michael Lloyd's house, the producer. He lives across the street from me, has a wonderful state-of-the-art recording studio, although that's not where we recorded. And we said, we want to have a meeting to discuss it. And so one by one, the arrangers, Billy May was the only one who demurred, saying he'd put in too many black specks on paper. And he wished me well. But all the other great arrangers came. I swear some of them had paper bags over their heads so they wouldn't be known, or their collars turned up. They didn't want anybody to know they were coming to talk about this in case they didn't do it. But when they saw Ralph Carmichael, Tommy Oliver, goodness, all these great arrangers, including John Clayton, big band jazz experts, when they looked and saw that they were all going to be on board, and I was giving each arranger one song that had already been a hit, a million-selling hit, but now I wanted them to do another version and see if we could come up with another hit on that song, each one knew now that these other top arrangers were involved and might really, I said, I want you each to give me your best on one arrangement. So each one had to do it, because if he gave me a half-hearted attempt, and somebody else had a big hit, you know, and they obviously hadn't tried. That wasn't going to work. So for them, so John Clayton, I talked to him two or three times. Great, great bassist and great jazz arranger, and he was a little bit wary. I said, "Look, John, this is a great song. I know you can come up with a real good musical treatment, because it is a long way to the top if you want to rock and roll." And boy, he gave me a great arrangement. You want to play a little of it?
Yeah, yeah. This is something I never thought I'd be doing on radio. But here's Pat Boone from the album No More Mr. Nice Guy, and it's A Long Way to the Top.
Hey, running down the highway, going to a show. Stop at all the byways, playing rock and roll. Getting robbed, getting stoned, getting beat up, broken bone, getting mad, getting took. I tell you folks, it's harder than it looks. It's a long way to the top if you want to rock and roll. It's a long way to the top if you want to rock and roll.
Wanna rock and roll.
Think it's easy doing one night stand. Diver, you've been down too long in the midnight sea. Oh, what's becoming of me?
Metalhead Pat Boone with the album No More Mr. Nice Guy.
And that would be nice.
And it's available now, the 20th anniversary re-release. Came out 20 years ago.
Yeah, man, it just astonishes me that much time has washed over under the bridge, over the dam.
And you got the late Ronnie James Dio to participate. He sang on Holy
sure
Diver.
Did.
How did that happen?
Well, we asked him, and we were doing the song, and I didn't know him, but Michael Lloyd did, or yeah, I think it's Michael Lloyd, who was rock producer, and Jeff Weber, the big band jazz producer, and two producers worked together to combine two genres of music. I mean, nobody had ever done this or even thought of such a thing. But as we were doing Holy Diver, Ralph.
That's all right. We're not live, so.
Okay, gosh. Carmichael.
Oh, Ralph Carmichael. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Ralph Carmichael was writing the arrangement, and we called Ronnie James Dio, who'd worked with Ozzy, of course, Black Sabbath and all, and told him we were doing Holy Diver, and would he come in and sing some of it with me? And he did. And he still has that
high, piercing
voice.
Yeah.
Fabulous. And we did Holy Diver together in the studio of Michael Lloyd across the street from my home. And he was so gracious and so good. And I really love that treatment of Holy Diver.
Do you still tour? You play out and you do cover a couple of these in your concert?
I do concerts. I'm not doing touring. In fact, everywhere I go now, I tell people I'm on my last go-round. It's not a tour. I just accept some concert invitations. I was at Niagara Falls for two nights recently this year and sold out the concert arena there in Niagara Falls. It went great. Was in San Juan Capistrano at a place called the Coach House about two or three weeks ago. And so we picked my spots. I'm going to Israel. I'll talk to you about that in a minute.
Yeah.
But, yeah, whenever I perform, I ask the audience if they knew about that album that created such a stir. And, of course, most people say, oh, yeah, but like they're not sure they want to know about it. And then, of course, I do one of the songs, and then they realize, oh, that is good music. And so it's just fun. It's another piece of an unbelievable career. You know, I started out singing rock and roll, rhythm and blues. There was no rock and roll. People don't realize this, but in 1955, when I made my first records, including Ain't That a Shame, it was my second record, I was covering rhythm and blues hits, which were not played on pop radio. And they weren't going to be, it appeared. You know, they had their own genre, their own stations, their own artists. But some of the record producers, including, thankfully, Dot Records, were starting to hear some really catchy songs that we could do, and we were calling them rock and roll. The phrase itself was kind of erotic over in rhythm and blues. You know, we're going to rock and roll all night long.
Uh-huh.
But we started calling our music rock and roll. Elvis, of course, did several songs like Hound Dog, and we both did Good Rockin' Tonight and others. And this thing called rock and roll, coming straight out of rhythm and blues, was becoming a big hit, of course, and it changed the face of music forever. But my first record was Two Hearts, Two Kisses by The Charms on the Dutone label.
Mm-hmm.
Million seller, first record. Second record, Ain't That a Shame, Fats Domino. And his was a number one R&B hit, sold 150,000, which was great. I did my version of his song. It sold 1.5 million, 10 times what his had with the pop audience. And people think I was somehow stealing something from Flats. He knew better.
Yeah.
He knew that my record, he was making money on every one of my records because he was the writer of the song. He made more money, as he said himself, from my record of his song than from his own. He even displayed a piano-shaped diamond ring when I appeared with him once down in New Orleans. And he said, this man bought me this ring with this song, You Made Me Cry. His record was Roll. Mine was Rock. If you compare the two, you'll hear that I sang it much more forcefully and slammingly as a rock song than his was a rolling rock, a rolling song, you know.
Right. That's interesting. That's interesting. We lost him a few days ago.
Yeah.
Did you keep in touch with him? And, yeah, you're right. I mean, people with you and Elvis, people do, you do get criticized for co-opting black music. I mean, but did you keep in touch with him over the years? Or?
Yeah. I didn't keep in touch with him, but we did talk from time to time. I called him once several years ago and even made a follow-up call because I was trying to get a new album done with him and Little Richard, and we were going to call it the Oreo album.
Oh, really?
With Little Richard on one side and Fats on the other, me in the middle, and I was doing another couple of songs of theirs, and they would do a couple of songs of mine, and at least one of each other's songs, and then maybe a couple of originals. And Mike Curb, who was really hot as a producer then, wanted to do it, but both Richard and Fats wanted a nice advance up front, and he wasn't going to pay it. And I wasn't going to pay it an advance. I wasn't going to get an advance, but it just didn't happen. It's a shame. I think they were both agreeable, and if I ever was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, which I have not been and probably won't be, even though I had more rock hits than some that are in there, but, you know, Jan Winter and the group that put the nominees together, just favorites of theirs, mm-hmm. and they don't consider me a rock and roller. So even though I had rock and roll chart hits and sold millions of rock records, they just don't consider that I ever was a rock and roller. They think I was somehow impeding instead of enhancing the careers of the original artists. There were many other artists originally that didn't get covered, and nobody knows them today. The ones that do know, that are known, are the ones that others of us artists covered their songs and made pop hits or rock and roll hits, and that introduced them to the wider audience.
Talk about your upcoming historic pilgrimage to the Holy Land.
Like my rhythm and blues songs, my heavy metal songs, all this is a part of my life, very important part.
Very
of my
interesting.
Life.
Yeah, tell us about it.
Well, as a kid growing up in Nashville, my family were churchgoers, and we even read the Bible as a family in devotionals at home. Not but that we were super religious. My dad, a building contractor, architect, mom, a registered nurse, very practical professions. But to them and to us, therefore, my brother, two sisters, our faith and our study of the Bible was just as practical as anything else and as real in our lives. And I knew then that the Bible, from the first words of Genesis in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, to the last words of the book of Revelation in the New Testament, it was written by Jews, for Jews, and about Jews, and that we Gentiles could get in on it by our acceptance of the Jewish Messiah, Jesus. So this was common knowledge. It was part of my life. So as my career took off and was going crazy, in 1959, the movie Exodus came out, and Paul Newman and Eva St. Meva Marie Saint and mm-hmm. so on, and that great song "Bum Bum Bum Bum" was a giant hit for Ronnie Tischer piano duo record, mm-hmm. and I wanted to sing it. And my manager contacted the publisher and asked if there would be were there lyrics I could sing, and was told there wouldn't be lyrics because three opinionated people had the right to veto any lyrics that had been submitted by professional artists. One was Ernest Gold, the composer of the melody. Of course, he had a right to choose the lyrics or say no to the wrong ones. And then the publisher, Chapel Music, had a big stake in it. And then Otto Preminger, the director-producer of the film. And they had turned down lyrics by professionals. So it was a Christmas Eve in 59, and my wife was begging me to quit listening to that Ronnie Tischer record, trying to get an idea for a lyric to submit to a professional writer, help her get the presents under the tree so we could go to bed. I said, "Honey, just one more time." I put the needle on the record. Bum, 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 bum. The words, "This land is mine," came to me. And I thought, that's it. That's the whole story of Exodus. Bum, 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 bum. God gave this land to me. I thought, I got to write this down, and I picked up a card and started writing on the back of it. And in 25 minutes, I'd written all the lyrics to that song. And I turned it over. I had written on the back of a Christmas card, so we printed out the lyrics, submitted them to the publisher. Immediately, all three received and approved the lyric, and I went in and recorded it, the best record I ever made. And it has become the second Jewish national anthem all these years since. And in Israel, last 2 years ago, I took over a copy of the Christmas card on which I had scribbled the words.
Interesting.
On the back of that card, and they're framed, and they're now on the wall of the Righteous Gentile at Yad Vashem, the Holocaust Museum. And I'm very proud of that, and I'm hosting a tour. I've been to Israel over 20 times. I, in fact, was given an official appointment by the Ministry of Tourism as a Christian ambassador of tourism. I've hosted big tours. I've been on others. I've been over just for other reasons, to, at the request of the government, to entertain the Israel troops. I appeared there last March, sold out shows in Tel Aviv. So I'm going to go one last time, host a tour next May, May 9th through the 20th, I think, or 19th. And we're going to take a big group, first class, everything, see all the things that you want to see when you go to Israel. It's like walking into the pages of the Bible. And we'll have a private meeting with Prime Minister Netanyahu, who is a fan of mine.
Oh, really?
He was at MIT in college when Elvis and I were having our big hits. And Prime Minister Netanyahu loves Speedy Gonzalez. Every time we're together, he's, "Hi, Speedy, how you doing?" Speedy Gonzalez. So my careers, I should say, I've had about five or six careers, but they have intertwined pertaining to Israel, because when I was in a bunker after the Six-Day War entertaining the troops and the occasional shells still coming in, a truce had been reached, but the demarcation had not been settled between Henry Kissinger and Syria and Egypt and Israel. He was trying to work out the lines of demarcation. And I was in a helmet, flak jacket, and a bunker up in occupied territory, part of what had been part of Syria. And at that point, but shells still coming in from time to time, and I'm just visiting the troops, and they say, "Sing for us, sing us something." I said, "Well, I don't have any music." And they said, "What do you know? Which ones are my songs?" They, like a chorus, they all said, "Speedy Gonzalez." So I sang Speedy Gonzalez singing in the bunker. But then I said, "Let me sing, this may be more appropriate." And I sang, "This land is mine. God gave this land to me." And it was more appropriate. It was a goosebumpy, goosebumpy moment. Later, Prime Minister Rabin, when I told him about that, he said, "Just a moment. Where were you?" I said, "In the northernmost bunker in occupied Syria." He said, he went to the map. He said, "You sang a prophecy." I said, "What?" He said, "Where you sang that evening is now part of the new map of Israel. This land is mine." And so, you know, I get goosebumps and tears knowing that my lyrics are on the wall of the Righteous Gentile.
Fascinating.
And I want to bring people over, as many as will come. Go to patboonisraeltour.com, and by all means, come along. This will be my last tour, and would love to make you, for that matter, and anybody else who wants to come who hasn't been to Israel, you ought to come.
That, yeah, and it's in May, you say?
May 9th, and through for 10 days, and everything about it, first rate, first class, very safe. And it is the 70th anniversary of the new nation of Israel, since they became a nation again in 1948.
It'll be next year, 2018.
Yeah.
Let me ask you something. We're talking a lot. This has been a fascinating interview. We're talking a lot about different genres and understanding different people. And, I mean, here we are talking about R&B and Israel and metal. And but... I want to ask you about, what do you think about the climate today? I mean, there seems to be some type of divisiveness in the air, I'm trying to be gentle with my words, but people so fractured and stuff. And I know you've been involved in politics with President Reagan and stuff, but I'd like to ask Pat Boone what he thinks about the climate today.
Well, I'm very troubled about it. There's two generations have grown up without the basis of our Constitution and our way of life being taught in school, in most cases. The Constitution For some reason, so many teachers and the NEA and all that are very liberal-minded, and they want to talk about, they even want to revise history, this idea of taking down statues of people who were notable Americans and who were part of our history, take them down because they don't agree with politics now. And that's so there's differences of political opinions and philosophies, but we used to be civil about them.
Right. That's what I'm talking. I'm talking about tone. I mean, compassion from our president. I mean, like, what happened to empathy and understanding?
I talked to Donald Trump himself when he was running, because we're acquaintances. I can't say close friends, but acquaintances. And he called me on the tennis court. I was on the tennis court because I'd said something positive about him on Fox News. And he called to thank me. And I said, well, you may not have heard everything. I said, I did think that our founding fathers would have welcomed a businessman like you running for highest office because they did not intend there to be career politicians. They wanted people to leave their professions, come represent their people for 2 years, 4 years, maybe six, and then go back to their former life and let somebody else do it, not settle in for 30, 40 years and retire wealthy as politicians. And I said, but I did say something else you might didn't hear, Donald, and that is I wish you would quit calling your opponents names. They were still debating. I said, because it doesn't sound presidential. It sounds schoolyardish, and a lot of people would hear what you have to say politically if you would to speak more civilly. I said, why don't you get some of Ronald Reagan's debates and have somebody play some tapes of how he stood firmly for what he believed in, but with respect for his opponent.
Exactly.
And people liked him because of that. Even if they disagreed with his positions, they liked the fact that he was polite and even humorous with people like Walter Mondale. And I said, I'll bet your own wife is wanting you to do that. And he laughed. But he's got that mindset. However, he's taken a beating for it. And he's not a stupid man. And I think he's going to finally realize that the tweeting and calling people names is counterproductive. And it's causing a lot of people, even some Republicans and some conservatives, to say, maybe we still agree with some of his positions, and he is trying to do what we elected him to do, but he's hurting himself and embarrassing us at the same time.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping, he's not stupid, and he'll begin to add up, and people around him who he still respects and can say, look, boss, look at this. This is not working for you. It's not working for us. We can get things done if we will be. And I look at him. He's calling and having meetings with his opponents, having them for lunch, dinner. Let's talk it over. Let's see what we can do together. Even alienating some of the staunch right-wing conservatives by taking more ameliorated positions. And so, I hope we work it out. I think change was necessary. I didn't like where we were going. I'd like to see us go in a more conservative, more constitutionally correct direction, but we got to do it with civility as well, or things just break down.
I know you're busy, so thank you so much, Mr. Pat Boone, for coming on Nocturnal Journal. No more Mr. Nice Guy, Pat Boone in a metal mood, and it's the 20th anniversary reissue is out now, right, Pat?
Yep, it is. It is, and if you can't find it in your store or on Amazon, just go to patboone.com. I will happily supply you.
Well, thank you for being so generous with your time, and we will see you real soon, okay?
Hope so. Hope so, man.
Keep on rocking, Pat.
Enjoyed it. All right.
All right, take care. Thanks.